This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
In April, Jerry Miller, an Illinois man who served 24 years for a rape he did not commit, became the 200th American prisoner cleared by DNA evidence. His case, like the 199 others before him, represented a catastrophic failure of the criminal justice system. When an airplane crashes, investigators pore over the wreckage to discover what went wrong and to learn from the experience. The justice system has not done anything similar. But a new study does. Brandon Garrett is a UVA law professor, and for the first time, he has systematically examined those 200 cases in which innocent people served an average of 12 years in prison. Innocent people. In each case, the evidence used to convict them was at least flawed and often false, yet juries, trial judges, and appellate courts failed to notice. My guest live in studio is Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, Brandon Garrett. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Coy.
I appreciate it. And also, I want to just, before we go any further, I want to congratulate you. We were talking before we went on the air that you are soon to be a daddy for the first time, and I wish you and your wife well. That is wonderful, exciting, happy news.
Thank you. We're looking forward to raising our new child in Charlottesville.
That's really great. Tell me, let's do a little Brandon Garrett 101, a little bit about your background, where you're from, because I know you haven't been here very long.
Well, I've lived in Charlottesville for 2 years. My wife and I both teach at the law school. Carrie Abrams teaches family law, immigration law, and feminist legal theory. I teach criminal justice and civil rights related classes. Before moving here, I worked for Cochran Neufeld Scheck in New York City. And those names should be familiar. It's Johnny Cochran, Barry Scheck, and Peter Neufeld, members of the OJ Dream Team. But they formed a civil rights law firm together after they worked on the Abner Louima case. And a lot of what I did there was work on the wrongful conviction cases of people who are exonerated by DNA evidence.
And doesn't Barry Scheck have the organization that, explain that to us exactly what he does.
Scheck and Neufeld founded the Innocence Project.
That's right.
And the Innocence Project was responsible for exonerating many of these 200 people, it's now 205, who've been found innocent through DNA testing. They started getting letters in the late 80s and founded this group together to start to represent these people once DNA technology turned into a viable means to prove innocence.
My guest is Brandon Garrett, UVA professor of law. What was going on in your career when you decided that, you know, this is a study that nobody's done and somebody has to do this? We have to take a close look at what is now hundreds of cases where people were wrongfully convicted and sent to death row.
I think what happened is I've been teaching habeas corpus at UVA School of Law, and the students have been asking me great questions about, you know, why did the system fail in the cases of people like Earl Washington? The first time I taught habeas corpus was the same spring that Earl Washington's civil case was going on here in Charlottesville. So all of my students were following that trial and really interested in that case. And we were reading all of these Fourth Circuit opinions and state court opinions here in Virginia, where every step of the way, he was raising issues about his confession and they were raising issues about his mental retardation. And every step of the way, the courts denied him relief. And it was occurring to me that it would be really interesting to see what happened in the other cases where someone was proven innocent later, just to try to learn something about our criminal appeals process. And so the study's been a couple of years in the making, and I had a great team of UVA law students who helped do the research and helped pour through all these decisions to try to figure out if there are any patterns.
So now let's get down to brass tacks here. What did y'all learn? What did your team discover when you took a look at all of these wrongful convictions?
A number of things which I never expected to see. Some things I did expect. So these cases are mostly rape cases because those are the cases where biological material is relevant to the issue of who did the crime. And in most rape cases where identity is an issue, those are cases where it's a stranger rape. And most of those cases, stranger rapes, tend to involve the victim saying, that's the guy who did it. And so most of these cases involved eyewitness identifications, which in retrospect turned out to be wrong. The cases that don't involve those kind of stranger rapes, more of the murder cases, there are fewer of those. Those tend to involve confessions, jailhouse informants. Police have a lot less to go on if there's no victim around to say who the perpetrator was. The main surprise for me is that people during their appeals, they're innocent. You'd think that they would be attacking these facts. They would be attacking the eyewitness identification, saying the victim got it wrong. Or they attack the confession and say, look, I didn't mean to confess. There was a false confession. The police coerced me, something like that. But significant percentages of these people never raised those issues during their appeals. And you'd ask, well, what were they doing during their appeals? They weren't raising their innocence either most of the time. And I have one explanation for why they might not have brought those factual challenges or those innocent claims. And the reason may be is that whenever they did bring innocence claims or factual challenges, they almost always lost. And so their lawyers may have advised them, look, those are losing claims. Don't bother to challenge the facts. The courts won't listen.
My guest is Brandon Garrett, a professor of law at the University of Virginia and the author of a new study, the first of its kind here in America, which takes a very close and critical look at the wrongful convictions of over 200 Americans who were found guilty of crimes they didn't commit and sent to death row, or in other cases, just sitting in jail for, you know, Jerry Miller's case for 24 years. Unbelievable. Brandon, have you ever met any of these guys?
Yes. When I was a lawyer working in New York, I represented a few of these guys. The first trial that I did was a case seeking compensation on behalf of one of these exonerees. So I've met a number of them. And obviously, it's a devastating experience to be in prison all those years knowing that you're innocent.
Yeah. Is there any theme that, to the reaction? Is there any common theme to the reaction when they get out besides elation and joy? Are they angry by and large, or do you often find out that what are they like?
You know, after any period of time in prison knowing that you're innocent, you have to, just to survive, find some way to cope with that situation. And different people have different ways of coping, and some emerge from prison totally broken. And some emerged with facing enormous challenges and difficulties, but able to resurrect their lives. You know, it's quite hard for these people to get some kind of compensation for what they suffered in order to rebuild their lives. You know, these are people who often were arrested when they were young, you know, during their formative years, when they should have been finishing high school or trying to go to college or working at their first jobs. And, you know, states like Virginia don't offer automatic compensation if someone is wrongfully convicted.
Are there states that do?
More and more states are passing statutes like that. And, you know, if you think of this Earl Washington trial here in Charlottesville, he received, you know, a $2 million verdict and ultimately received that money in a settlement. But it took years of federal litigation for him to obtain that money. A lot of states are thinking, you know, we don't want these million-dollar verdicts that only some people get and they have to wait years to get it. Better to offer some automatic compensation to someone found innocent. It doesn't have to be that much money, but I think most exonerees would rather have something and be able to get it automatically and quickly without having to wait years and hire lawyers.
So they can move on with their life.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so more and more states have been passing those statutes. I think it's something that we should be thinking about here in Virginia.
Brandon Garrett is a professor of law at the University of Virginia. Tell us some more of the findings that really stick out in your mind from the study that you did.
Well, a lot of courts, in these cases of people who we now know are innocent, concluded that these people were obviously guilty and therefore deserve no relief. So some courts were troubled by potential constitutional violations. But they said, oh, the error is harmless because of all the solid evidence of guilt in their cases. And of course, we now know that evidence was not so solid. Even more disturbing, perhaps, 12 courts denied these innocent appellants relief despite DNA test results that had already said they were innocent. And so those initial test results were in, and the court said, we're not convinced by that either.
Oh, you're kidding.
And
so there was actually DNA evidence in some of these cases, and they were sent to jail anyway.
As a matter of fact, the Fourth Circuit, which we sit in, Virginia is one of the states that's in the federal Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, has done that in two separate cases. And, you know, I think all of this sheds light on and, you know, how bad appellate judges can be. And part of it is not their fault. It's just that the rules that they're operating under strongly defer to the jury verdict. Our system presumes that the jury heard the facts. They were the ones who saw the witnesses. They were the ones who heard the case. We can't second guess them after the fact. Problem is that, you know, we now have DNA evidence. We have things that are more reliable than some of the evidence they might have heard at the time. And appellate judges are also in a hard position because they may have a highly incomplete record. You know, what's the appellate judge supposed to do if the eyewitness at trial said, I'm certain that's the guy who did it? The appellate judges don't have a videotape of the identification. They don't have a videotape of the confession in most states. If they had that kind of a record, maybe they could do a better job of judging innocence. But absent those kind of reforms to give the appellate judges a better record, I think we can understand why these judges don't get it right, at least in the cases that I studied.
You're listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now, thanks to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. If you want to get involved with the show, feel free to comment on our blog at sevillepodcast.com.
My guest in studio is Brandon Garrett, a professor of law at the University of Virginia and the author of a new study, the first of its kind here in America, which takes a very critical and close look at the wrongful convictions of hundreds of Americans who've been sitting in prisons or on death row. What else did you turn up in the study? And by the way, how long did it take? What the actual study, the crunching the numbers, and I imagine there were many, many files you had to look at here.
It took about 2 years, and most of that was collecting the data from all of these different judicial decisions and crunching the numbers. Of course, I stopped this last March when the number hit 200, which made it a round number. The mathematics weren't too hard. You know, if you have 110 people out of 200 who are convicted based on forensic evidence, then you know that's 55%.
Right,
so,
right.
So the statistics weren't complicated, although I did a few more complicated things. But it took a long time to look through all of these people's decisions. What I was surprised at is more than two-thirds of them had substantial written opinions during their appeals, where we could get a sense of what kind of claims they were raising and what courts were ruling on them. A lot of criminal cases, it's very hard to figure out what happened during their appeals. But we had a lot of information to go on here.
And what else did you learn in the study?
One of the things I focused on was why is it that these people weren't getting the kind of relief that we would expect since they're innocent?
The system working?
In some ways we can't. You know, the million-dollar question is how many innocent people are in our prisons? And that's not a question that my study answers, and it's not a question I think we can answer right now, because obviously the people who did get relief would never need to seek DNA testing in order to secure their release from prison. And so hopefully our system works better and better, and we catch these kind of errors before trial, hopefully. One thing I tried to figure out is, you know, there are a number of these innocent people, and I couldn't believe this, who had two or three trials. Just trial after trial after trial. And each time the court said there's a serious error here and they sent it back, prosecutors went ahead anyway. And so this innocent person would be convicted time and time again. And so there's a significant chunk of these people, about 10%, who got their trials reversed, but they just kept on getting convicted again before the DNA testing ultimately proved that they were innocent. And so I wanted to see, is that normal for there to be that many reversals in this group? Is it because judges sense they're innocent somehow? And what I found was no, that actually in a random group of rape and murder cases, similar charges, similar states, and similar years, there's actually also a high reversal rate in those cases too. So it looks like our system just produces a fair number of errors in these most serious criminal cases. And that should trouble us too. We might like to think, at least, or hope, that really serious criminal cases, rapes, murders, the kind of thing where people face life in prison or decades in prison, that's where our system should get it right. It looks like, at least in the appellate judge's eyes, we're not getting it right in a significant chunk of the time in those very serious cases.
Well, this is really chilling. And it's not very encouraging. You know what I mean? Because we sort of assume there's some things in our country that just work. There's some things that work. And you would assume, I mean, the average Joe on the street assumes that by and large, the criminal justice system works and works pretty well. But when you really pull out the magnifying glass and you look really closely at it, it's a whole lot of people often making a whole lot of mistakes.
Well, and this is a special magnifying glass looking just at the most serious criminal cases. And actually, I didn't talk in this study because it's already been done. Even higher error rates can be found in death penalty cases, where upwards of two-thirds of death penalty cases are reversed on appeal because of serious errors. And you know that's way higher than the 10% in these rape and murder cases, the ones that aren't death penalty cases. And so, you know, we've known for some time that the most complicated and serious criminal cases are far more error prone. There's one assumption that many people have, which is that, well, you know, there's DNA testing around now. Maybe these people were wrongly convicted because they couldn't get DNA testing back then in the 1980s or whatever. But now, you know, there's always DNA testing done. Hopefully we catch these before a trial. But I found something else which surprised me and which is also disturbing. More than a quarter of these exonerations, 53 out of the 200, were for people who were convicted at a time when DNA was available. And they were convicted anyway.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
And there are a bunch of reasons. In some of the cases, the technology just improved. And DNA technology just keeps improving. And so when people say, oh, the problem is solved, we have DNA now, well, DNA keeps changing and becomes more and more sophisticated and accurate, and new techniques have evolved which can test. You know, now we can test even a few cells, whereas in the early 90s, you really needed a big sample of stuff to run through a DNA test. Now we can test the smallest little particles, but it's not just the technology changing. A lot of these cases were examples where lawyers should have requested DNA testing, but incompetent defense lawyers just didn't do it. Another significant chunk of cases were cases where the government concealed biological evidence and hid the fact that DNA testing could be done, or they fraudulently misrepresented the test results, saying, oh, it's inconclusive, when it turns out it was conclusive and the guy was innocent. There were also a fair number of cases. So those, if you think those cases are disturbing, there's another group of cases where the jury convicted, even though the DNA testing had excluded the guy. But the jury convicted anyway. The prosecutor came up with some sort of hypothetical explanation, and it wasn't until there was a match in a DNA database with the actual perpetrator that our system finally said, okay, this guy really is innocent. The DNA test was right.
Wow. Brandon Garrett, professor of law at the University of Virginia. I got about a minute left, but what is it we should do? I mean, I don't know if your study had any recommendations, but what is it we should be doing as citizens? Every one of us, I'm sure, who wants to see this system be the best in the world and work well and work right in every time.
Well, why don't we just start locally with Virginia? One thing Virginia has been doing, which is good, is that they've been looking back at old cases and auditing DNA cases to find out whether more retesting can be done. That's great. One thing Virginia has not done, though, is to try to give judges a better record to go on so that they can judge innocence better. Virginia doesn't require videotaping of interrogations. Earl Washington never would have been convicted if we could have seen a videotape and known right away that he was mentally limited and actually didn't know anything about the crime that he was wrongfully convicted of. Virginia also hasn't required lineup reform to try to make sure that eyewitnesses provide a more accurate identification and that there's a better record. A lot of states have done it. Virginia hasn't. And so I think there's a lot that Virginia could do to improve the accuracy of our criminal system.
Brandon Garrett with the University of Virginia School of Law. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for doing this study.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.